We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about a number of things. In part, we'll be talking about life today in Japan. We'll also try to talk a little bit about the work of anthropologists who go and who visit other places and who get to know other people, and about how sometimes it's possible for researchers to form bonds with the people they have come to know, so that they become more than research subjects, they actually become friends. Our guests here this morning include Keith Brown, who is a professor emeritus of anthropology at the University of Pittsburgh, and who's been doing work in Japan for a long time. He first made his first visit there in 1961 when he was a graduate student, and he has been going back ever since. He is the subject of a documentary that will be shown on the U of I campus tonight at 7 o'clock. And the man who made the documentary is here, too. And his name is David Plath. He is Emeritus Professor of Anthropology here at the University of Illinois and has also been writing about Japan and Japanese life for a long time and has made a number of documentaries. This is just the most recent. The title is Can't Go Native, and he produced and directed it. And if you'd like to see it, you stop by the Knight Auditorium on the campus tonight at 7. That's in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory, and it's free to anybody who would like to attend. And Professor Brown will be there, and there'll be some discussion afterwards. So definitely, folks who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, stop by. It's a nice movie. I think that you would enjoy seeing it. And of course, as we talk here on the program, questions and comments are welcome from people who are listening. If you're going to call, you use one of two numbers here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. You may also email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you both very much for being
here. Thanks for
inviting us.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
I want to start out and have Professor Brown talk a little bit about himself. You were born in Iowa, Ames?
Born on the agronomy farm in Ames, Iowa. So rural life was something that was familiar to me. And I love the Midwest, and it's gorgeous being back here now. It's a lovely time of the year. So when I went to a village in Japan, rural life was familiar. That was about the only thing that was familiar.
Yeah. Well, that seems like kind of a long way for an Iowa farm boy, first to go to University of Chicago for your PhD and then to go to Japan. When did you decide that you wanted to be an anthropologist?
I was a sociology major in undergraduate school, and there came a point when I didn't think I could see the people. I wanted to see the people, but what I saw were numbers and this kind of analysis. Mm-hmm. So I wanted a discipline where I could see the people, interact with the people. And anthropology, of course, is just that. You go to the field and you talk with people, or more than talk, you listen to people. And so I listened a lot, and that fit me just perfectly. And it was one of the best decisions, marrying my wife, another. One of the best decisions I ever made was going into anthropology and then Japanese studies. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese studies came from a question. I had not been there in the military. I had not been a missionary family in Japan. Many of my predecessors came from those kinds of backgrounds. But I had a question. What is the difference in modernization and westernization? And Japan was the only fully modern non-Western society, so I had to go to Japan. Lucked out again, David. Yeah. It was great.
Now, here, let me turn to Dave Plath, because, and you can tell me whether within your field, being able to have as long a relationship with a particular place as Professor Brown has, is that unusual?
It's, I would say it's quite unusual. Keith's record with the community of Mizusawa, almost 50, you know, next year he celebrates the 50th anniversary of the fieldwork, may not be a Guinness Book of Records marker, but I don't offhand know of any other anthropologist who's gone back to the same community consistently for 50 years. You know, My own field work in Japan was 2 years earlier than Keyes. I've continued to go back, but I've been a butterfly. I've gone around to many different places, and that's probably the more common thing for most anthropologists.
It seems that something about this particular, early on, something about this particular place, or maybe it was the people that you met, or maybe it was a little bit of both, really grabbed you. Do you know what that was?
You understand perfectly. What grabbed me initially was I wanted to do a controlled comparison. And by that, I mean I wanted to compare a rural area with an urban area. And if I had compared the village with Tokyo, that's apples and oranges. Tokyo was flattened in the war and had totally different historical experience. So I decided then I would do my second study, the urban study, in town, which was about 5 miles away. And then I could see what is the impact of an urban environment on the people that culturally are and historically are the same. And that worked out well. And, of course, after I did this second study, I was hooked. Mm-hmm. And I had so many good friends, and I felt so comfortable in Mizusawa that I wanted to do a third study in Mizusawa. All good anthropologists, when they come up with a new project, they change sites, as Dave Plath did. And they go to a different area. So most people don't stay in one site like I did. And the youngsters who have seen this film say, people don't do anthropology like that. They don't do community studies like that.
Yeah. Well, it's really remarkable, the kind of connection, clearly, that you formed with this place and these people. And I think for me, it's very moving. For example, you see in the movie where you talk about the fact that when you go there today, one of the things that you do is you visit the cemetery. And you go to see people who you first met when you started going there who have passed. So to have that kind of and I'm sure that now you know their children, and to have that kind of multi-generational perspective, I'm sure is quite rare.
It is, and it's also a great joy. A good friend on my first trip in the early 60s, now gone, died in a tractor accident. Lovely man, taught me a lot. His son, now in his mid-50s probably, is also a very good friend. And so we've made that transition from one generation to another. In Mizusawa, going to visit the ancestors in the cemetery is a big thing. And somehow I've acquired that. So going and seeing my friends in the cemetery is something I want to do, and I do it.
Yeah. Something else I think is really striking that you talk about is how common extended families and to have them all under one roof are. And I'm sure that I noted it down somewhere when I was watching the piece, is about how many households there are there that have three generations all living in the same house.
That's common. Less so, and especially now that it's getting more affluent. So typically a young couple, when they get married, they will go off into their own apartment. The wealthy people used to do this in the old days. The landlord's family did this. Then typically when the kids become school age, elementary school, they may move back to the natal home. And then they've got the built-in babysitter and grandma, and the wife can continue to work. So there are advantages in this three-generational household. And then they've got grandma who can do the various kinds of domestic chores. And, of course, she's glad to have her. Most of the time, she's glad to have her grandchildren there and her daughter-in-law there. In the old days, they talked about the tyranny of the mother-in-law. Now mm-hmm. they talk about the tyranny of the daughter-in-law. She's the boss.
Yeah.
And there's some tension in that. So typically, if they can, they will build an apartment right next door. And I've seen one family in which the young couple moved next door in that apartment. And then as they got older and started taking over the affairs of the house, the older couple moved to the apartment next door and the younger couple took the main house. These kinds of arrangements are flexible and they depend upon the people in the house. And they're trying to work out these family relationships like we are.
Yeah. Let me just very quickly introduce again our guests. Keith Brown is an emeritus professor of anthropology at University of Pittsburgh, and David Plath is emeritus professor of anthropology here at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Dave has made a documentary about Keith and about his long-term relationship with this community in northeastern Japan, where he's done field work now for going on 50 years. Can't Go Native, that's the title. And if you'd like to see it, it'll be shown tonight on the campus, 7 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium. It's free if you'd like to attend. That's in the Spurlock Museum. And questions here, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Now, I know that the two of you, at least one anthropological conference, did a presentation where you showed the documentary and then you talked, and that's kind of what you're doing here tonight. And what I want to do is ask David Plath, as an anthropologist, as a colleague, a man who works in this field. Now, when I watch this documentary, I'm sure that I see it one way. But as anthropologists look at the experience that Professor Brown has had, what sort of questions do they ask, and are there particular issues that they raise that have to do with the fact that he's been doing this for a long time and has built this relationship with some of the people that are the subjects of the work?
Yeah, in many ways, I think Keith should answer that one. But let me say, for me, as a filmmaker, his long-term involvement with the people made it more easy than any other film I've made to get spontaneous reactions from people, not necessarily hamming it up for the camera, because they know Keith so well, they're relating to him. Sure, they know the camera's there, but it's the kind of thing you more easily get if you're filming somebody who's, let's say, a potter throwing a pot. He's so busy attending to that pot, he's not that concerned about that there's a camera going. Mm-hmm. Well, socially, this is like that. They're so concerned teasing Keith or whatever. But in terms of the issues for an anthropologist, Keith has thought about these for 50 years.
Yeah. Well, what about that?
That's an issue to everybody but me, I guess. The issue of, can I be objective when these people are close friends? And one of the beautiful things that comes out of this film, and it's a beautiful film, and I encourage people to look at it. Dave has done a great job. At the end, there's a sequence of pictures of me and virtually the first guy I met when I went to Mizusawa in 1961. And then we remained close, and he was a patron of mine in a variety of activities, and the family I lived with was his oldest sister's family and stuff. So we were very close. And what Dave did in the film was, at the end, he showed a series of pictures that we had of the two of us together at different times in this 50 years. And then the last scene is me talking at his funeral 2 years ago. And I saw that, and then I was supposed to get up after the film ended and talk to this group of anthropologists who were Japanese specialists. I got up and I was choked up. I couldn't talk. So clearly there was an emotional thing in my relationship to those people. And to some, that may intrude on the scientific objectivity of me looking at this village as an anthropologist. I don't think so, because what that has done is given me some intimacies, some information that I normally wouldn't get. And I can go there for a short visit, and I know the context, and so people don't need to explain the whole thing, and I understand what the implications of various situations are. So there's a beauty of having this long-term relationship. The family that I lived with, I decided early, were not going to be the objects of a study. They were going to be friends. I didn't want them feeling that every time I talked with them, this was being recorded and it was going to come out in a publication later. They were just friends. And I mentioned this in the film, and an anthropologist, a very well-known anthropologist, said, how can I keep them out of bounds for the study? Well, I decided to do that just because of the human relationships. So there is a relationship between the human and the anthropology and the science. I hope I've been able to work them both for good benefit. But you were right that there's that problem in the minds of some.
I would like to have you talk a little bit about what life is like in this part of Japan and sort of my understanding that if for a long time this was a part of Japan that maybe if you were in Tokyo, you thought this was the backwater. This was primitive.
Exactly.
And even now, by bullet train, it takes 3 hours to get there. So that's still, in many ways, both literally and metaphorically, this is a long way from Tokyo.
2 hours and 46 minutes. You understand exactly. And this was referred to as the Tibet of Japan. And if they show a movie today and they want to show a country bumpkin, typically they will have an accent that comes from that dialect that comes from that area. So it's still seen that way. Mm-hmm. But it is only 2 hours and 46 minutes. I've gone in the morning to Tokyo, done the business at the embassy or wherever, and returned in the evening. And they all have the internet, and I'm on email contact with them, and they have access to all of the modern accoutrements. So I don't see it as backwards, but that's the popular perception of it. In those days, it used to take me 13 hours by regular train, 9 by express train. So that was a big trip, and many of the people didn't go to Tokyo.
Yeah.
So it's the Iowa of Japan? It's the Iowa of Japan?
See,
what is he talking about? I have the foggiest idea what he's talking about.
Well, you know, flatlanders, what do they know? I think that's because you said earlier you talked about growing up in Ames and how your dad ran the university research farm.
Right.
Right. And, and you and your two brothers grew up on that farm and worked on that farm.
Right.
And so for you, I think it was interesting that you earlier talked about the fact that when you got to Japan, this was a rural area. A lot of people there are farmers that maybe a lot of things about life were strange and seemed odd to you. And yet at the same time, things about this place were very familiar, felt like, well, yeah, OK, I think I kind of understand what this frame of mind is because that was kind of what I grew up with.
Yes. Early in my school days, I went to a one-room schoolhouse. And towards the end, there were 8 kids in that school, 1 teacher, and 4 of the kids were Browns. And I was the last of the Browns. And so when they saw that, the school board saw that, they figured, well, we'd better close the school. Then we went to town for school. I get to Mizusawa, and I get to the village of Shinjo. And lo and behold, there's a one-room schoolhouse. And it has gone through the same transition. At one time, it had 30-some kids and 3 teachers. And when I got there, it had about 10 kids and 1 teacher. And, of course, they closed the school. So those kinds of things of rural life were familiar to me. Mm-hmm. But there were some things that were not familiar. I grew up in car culture. Of course, we had a car in Ames. Ames is the modern world. In spite of what Dave Plath may say. And therefore, we had car culture. I got to Shinjo in Mizusawa. Not a single family had a car. We were all dependent upon the bicycle. So I had to learn bicycle culture.
It's interesting to me, and just from what little I've read about this part of Japan, that at the same time as people in the capital, I'm sure, in Tokyo, in big cities, think that somehow this is very backward and this is like the West, you know, it's like the Midwest. That also people think of this place as a place where Japanese culture, though, is somehow preserved. That both of those things are true. That it's a place where time has stood still. Is that something that people still think about Tohoku?
You understand perfectly. That is part of the image, that this is the museum of traditional Japanese culture. And that comes with 2 edges to it. One is, that's good. This is basic Japanese culture, and we should all appreciate and applaud this. The other is, it's backwards, and we've moved on. So a famous sociologist did a study of a village and then compared it with downtown Tokyo and said, this is the direction of change. Well, that's not quite true. Tokyo also has a long history. some of it may be older than Mississauga. Mississauga, by its name, suggests it was swampland in the old days. So it's a recent development.
Yeah, it was not one of the main reasons for making the film, but I would hope that viewers would get some sense that this is Mississauga, the Tohoku, this is flyover country Japan. And an awful lot that's going on there is like flyover country here in Champaign County. The media just aren't paying attention to the internal dynamics of change that are going on there as they are here in central Illinois, which are not the same dynamics that's going on in New York City or even in Chicago.
Yeah. Would there have been a time in Japan where if you said to people you were going to Mississauga to study modernization, they would have said, what, modernization there?
I think, and yeah. I think people in the big city probably still think that. However, Mississauga famous products include a former prime minister, Ozawa Ichiro, who is the most powerful man in Japan now, Secretary General of the party in power. He's from Mississauga, and there are a lot of famous people that come from Mississauga, so I'm not sure people who know would say that, but that may be part of the problem. Mississauga, of course, has really changed, and the new culture, the car culture, is new, and the irrigation system is an underground pipe system, so they can set the sensors to 5 centimeters of water, and then they can go to Hong Kong for shopping. And they do take these international trips. And life has changed, and life has gotten good. And I had one good friend who said, Brown, you know, today we even eat sushi. In the old days, they couldn't afford, when I got there in 61, they couldn't afford fish maybe more than once a month. Mm-hmm. Now they eat sushi. So the good old days, those traditional old days, for most people, aren't so good. They like it the way it's become. Some problems.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Let me introduce again our guests, and we'll get some callers in here. Keith Brown is Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at University of Pittsburgh. David Plath is Emeritus Professor of Anthropology here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Both of them have done a lot of writing and thinking about and talking about contemporary life in Japan. And Keith Brown is the subject of a documentary by David Plath about his long association with this town, Mississauga, in northeastern Japan. He's been going there ever since 1961 and writing about life there. And if you'd like to find out more about this or learn more about this or see some of this, you can stop in tonight at 7. Go to the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus. It's free, and they'll be showing the film Can't Go Native, and then afterwards there'll be some conversation.
Well, and I would like to add, David, that at 6:30, Jason Finkelman, who composed the music for the film, will be giving a demonstration of the array of sometimes exotic instruments that he has used in making the music for the film.
Very good, very good, very good. Well, let's talk with some of the people here who are listening. We have they've been patient, and start with someone here in Savoy, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I would like to ask Professor Brown a question about the youngest generation. He's close to the olders and the elders, but I was wondering what the younger grandchildren thought about his long-term presence. For example, do they ever ask him about the old days or older practices that no longer are followed? So is he a reference or a source of knowledge for the youngest generation about their community? That's my question.
No, lovely question.
Great question. Thank you. One of the most beautiful experiences I had was several years ago, a friend who was head of the PTA Association asked me to come talk to an assembly of second graders of middle school. Those are 14-year-olds. And I was scared to death. What is an old guy like me going to have to say to 14-year-olds that will keep their interest? And they're sitting on the hardwood floors of the gymnasium, and they told me to talk for 90 minutes, which is typical for a lecture in Japan. And I went, and what I took was also photos that I'd taken over the years. When I first got there, I was the village photographer, which was common for us anthropologists at that time because we had the only camera. So I took a lot of pictures and stuff, some of them colored slides and these sorts of things. So I showed them, and their grandparents were in these pictures. And the guy that invited me, the head of the PTA Association, was in these pictures. He was a little kid then. He always says he was a little kid with a runny nose, and that's probably the case, but I don't remember that. And I showed the pictures of their grandparents and their village and the great scenery that comes out so clearly in David Plath's documentary. It is a gorgeous place. And these kids then got to see what their grandparents' life was all about, what the technology for farming was all about. It was a technology that none of these kids knew. I talk with these kids now and then when I go to their families because they're there. And I go to schools and talk with them, but not much. So I don't know youth culture as much as I should. But I came away from that assembly experience thinking, these kids are great. I'm not worried about the new generation in Japan. And there's lots of talk about the new generation that is going to pot, literally and figuratively. And I don't see it. The kids are doing great. And they have the same aspirations that their parents did. Education is important to them. They're going to cram schools for English and other things. And I see kids in English schools, and they're learning their English much better than did their grandparents two generations ago. So the young kids are doing well. What the young women are not doing is getting married. And that means that the young men are not getting married. So we have a lot of people in their 30s and 40s who are not married. And this is characteristic of the total country, not just Mizuzawa.
Does that caller, are you still there?
Well, yes, I'm still here because this is very interesting, and I think it really gets into changes that have occurred in the community. But I wondered if any of the younger generation ever regard Professor Brown as a cultural resource, in other words, to learn about the history, or is he just a visitor, a long-term visitor and friend of the older families? And I'll sign off and listen to the answer to that. Thank you.
Okay.
My feeling on that is they don't see me as a resource on the real history, although that sometimes happens, and it doesn't happen with the kids. It happens with the older people. They will come to me and say, do you have documents on this or this or this, or what did you find out about that? And there are projects that I have done that they have then picked up later. So the older people will see me as a resource. I don't think the younger kids see me as a resource of a history that they ought to know. What they want to know from me is, what do I think of them? And what do I think of their community? They're interested in their community. Typically, I will get invited to give a talk comparing Japanese family with American family. And they want about 30 seconds on the American family, and then they want 89 minutes on what I think about the Japanese family. So they want my perceptions of it. I'm not sure that the younger people want this as real history in the sense of this is what our community was all about. Older people do.
A different kind of experience showing photos that I took in my first field work, late 1950s, early 1960s, not to people in the community, but to Japanese students who would come here to the U of I campus. And they would look at that and realize many of those students were not from regional Japan. They were from mega cities Japan. Mm-hmm. They would look at that and they would say, that's not Japan. That can't be Japan. That's Vietnam. because you know, 1950s, people were still doing a great amount of the farm work by hand.
Yeah.
Not much mechanization yet.
Yeah. All right. Let's take another caller and we'll go to Urbana. Line two. Hello.
Yes, hello. In the last 50 years, the community has changed and the world has changed, but Keith Brown's gotten older. So I wondered how your maturity during this period has influenced your field work or your thinking. And I'll sign off and put the radio on.
All right.
Thank you, Ed.
Nice. I've gotten older. The joy of it is I have these relationships that have lasted a long time, and they're interconnected in this kind of thing. The negative, and mostly I see the negatives of getting older. In the old days, I was a know-nothing, and today I'm still a know-nothing. But since I've been at this so long, they think I ought to know something. And so they get annoyed that I'm still a know-nothing. And being older, I should know something. And not knowing something is troublesome. So it was better, it was easier just going into the village as a know-nothing youngster in my 20s and having them teach me. They want to teach me, and they want to make sure I get it right. They are really scared that I will get it wrong. So they put a lot of effort into making sure that I get it right. And they're very patient in trying to teach me. But as I've gotten older, then there's some irritation that I don't know these things. Or they will tell me, I told you that before. And, of course, one of the techniques in anthropology is we ask the same question over and over again to different people to get a different view of the same issue. And I've gotten caught doing that. Somebody said, you asked Saburo that this morning. What are you asking me? And getting older compounds that problem. So I don't see many advantages in getting older.
This is something that I really, and I promise we got some other callers here, that I wanted to at least touch on because it comes up, maybe not directly, but it comes up. And one of the things that we know about Japan is that it is has the world's most rapidly aging population. You know, the percentage of the population that are seniors is the highest in the world, and the projections are that it's going to continue to go up very dramatically. Does that, coupled with the, you know, the fact that you're a senior yourself, does that lead you to think more about issues related to aging or to want to ask questions about that or suggest to you that that's an area of research that someone, if not you, that someone really needs to be doing?
David Plath is the world's expert on this, so I should defer to him on that. I'll just give one quick comment. Of course, they're very concerned about it. Elder care is a major concern, and lots of people are doing studies on elder care. I'll just say one thing and then let David expound on that, and that is that the older people are getting older, sure, but they're also, by and large, healthy, and stroke is no longer the major killer that it used to be, and so I don't see people out there limping with stroke after effects. Mm-hmm. They're doing good things. So many of the older people don't want to be bothered with the younger people in the house. They have the resources and they have the wherewithal to lead a fun life. And they're doing that.
Well, that's interesting because Dave wrote this book, this really interesting book, 30 years ago, that, and I'm sure that you've written a lot since, looking at the issue of how people thought about maturity and aging. And I think that one of the interesting conclusions that you drew was that in a place where we think of conformity as being very important, that people feel that once they start to get older, they're entitled to actually show some individualism. That is that, you know, they're entitled to be who they are, and that's maybe not something that you can do when you're younger.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure how to pick up on that, but a couple of comments on the aging issue. One, in terms of social welfare and social support provisions, Japan has done extremely well in, you know, basically totally free medical care. Medicare here is good for what it does. It does not give you the almost total sense of security that you're not going to be wiped out by traumatic illnesses and things of that sort. Yes, there's a lot of research on aging. There's a problem with that. It's a good thing to do. But aging is not just a matter of old people. And so research on old people is important, mm-hmm. the aging of the world population means all of life is being stretched out. And there's a danger with demagogues of treating the issue of aging as an oil spill. And we just need to mop it up or just bury it under the ocean. Mm-hmm. Instead of seeing that if there's a problem of aging, it's a problem for everybody at all stages along the life course. And I'll stop at that, or I'll start orating.
Well, I'll tell you what. We have about 10, 12 minutes left. We have some other callers. Let's talk with some other folks, and we'll go to next. Line 3, and this is someone here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. Hello.
Hi. To both guests, what about language learning? Did you use tutors in the MLA system of questions and answers? Where's the library? Please repeat, etc. And 2, what about what's the visa in your passport? And do you keep a yen account open in a Fuji bank or a U.S. dollar account? Thanks. Well, listen, mm-hmm. off the air. What about your own medical expenses? Are you covered in Japan? Thanks.
Okay. Well, some practical questions. Can you talk about some of those things?
Yeah, great. In terms of money, that's what I remember right now. In terms of money, things have gotten very convenient. I had a bank account in Misasawa. I just left it there. One of the most brilliant things I ever did in 1971, I left a whole bunch of money. I was trying to decide whether I should take it out of the bank or not and convert it to dollars. And I decided to leave the bank and leave it in the Misasawa Bank. On the train going down to Tokyo, Nixon decided to let the dollar float or whatever, and the exchange rate dropped by about half, from 360 yen that many of you will remember down to about 200 yen to the dollar. So on that train ride, I made a bunch of money. A bunch of money meaning maybe $500. So now it's gotten really easy. What I can do today, I don't take traveler's checks, and I don't have that bank account anymore. What I do is I just take my cash card from my local bank in Pittsburgh, and I go to the post office, and I use a cash machine, and I get out my money in yen. So I don't need to be converting dollars into yen, and I don't need to be carrying money around. I can just get it there. And the exchange rate normally is fairly favorable for doing that. There's a fee, but $3 maybe each time, and I get $500 a shot. So that's okay. Medical expenses, fortunately, we've not needed medical expenses very much. And most of the time, I have a hard time paying for it because the local doctors do it for free. And likewise for dental care. My wife had very good dental care in Misasawa, and it was hard to pay the dentist for that dental care. So I haven't had a major expense while I've been in Misasawa. And the first question was also language. Mm. Language has been the curse for me. I was 27 when I started studying Japanese. It's too old. We want the kids in elementary school studying Japanese. And I'm impressed so many schools around here are teaching Japanese now. We want them learning language early. So I never got very good. And one of my, I want to say, ex-friends in Misasawa, when David was up there doing his filming, kept saying, "Wow, Plas-sensei, his language is so great. His intonation is so great. What's wrong with you, Brown?"
Now, were they really praising him, or they were just giving you a hard time?
Both.
I see.
No, his intonation is fantastic. And I'm really impressed. Language has been a problem. I have had tutors. The family we lived with had a high school student. He later came and lived with us for 2.5 years in the United States and went to college here. He and I would, or my family and Sumio, would exchange language instructions. So we would talk with him in English for a while and try and do some instruction. And he would tutor us in Japanese. And that was a great thing. But mostly the language I learned in the village. So some of my language was colloquial. And I was on a radio program like this one in Morioka, the prefectural capital. And I came back to the village and I got scolded because I used some colloquialisms, soska kind of thing, what it should have been, sodeska. And they said, you should know better than that. Well, I should have known better than that, but they taught me their language by just speaking, and that's the language I know. Fortunately, I don't know many bad words. I had to learn those from my sons who went to middle school, and they taught me all the dirty words.
Playground Japanese.
Oh.
We're coming to a point where you have maybe about 6-7 minutes left and some other callers, and I want to try to get these folks in. Let me again also introduce Keith Brown. He is Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at University of Pittsburgh. Also here in studio with us is David Plath, who's Professor Emeritus of Anthropology here at U of I. David has made a number of documentaries about Japan. He's been studying Japan for a long time. And tonight on the campus, they will show his most recent title is Can't Go Native, which is all about Keith Brown and his long association with Musasawa, this place in northeastern Japan. Tonight at 7 on the U of I campus, so if you'd like to stop by. And for at 6:30, the fellow who did the music for the documentary will be giving a demonstration. So you actually want to stop in earlier. Don't just show up at 7 o'clock. Come at 6:30. Other questions here. Let's talk with somebody in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Earlier you mentioned the younger ones, the women not wanting to get married, you know, and they're in their 30s, and in terms of in other words, have women in Japan, you know, there's been certainly difficulty with women here, getting some of the equal rights that men do, and, you know, certainly salaries and et cetera, et cetera. Is it the same factor there?
I think it's the same factor, and we can see it Hong Kong, Taiwan, China, around the world. Women gain some power, autonomy, independence when they have their own income. And women would like to have careers like we men have careers. That's hard to do in Japan, although you can become a teacher and then you can have a career. But mostly women have part-time jobs, being they can work 40, 44 hours a week, but they don't get all the benefits and they don't get the security of the job. That employs a lot of women. Women would like to continue to work. There are not the child care services of the same amount and the same variety in Japan that there are here. And certainly in Mizusawa, there are not those child care services. So grandmother is a great asset in providing child care services. There are some places, there are some kindergartens, so-called preschools, and there are after-school programs, but not much. So if a woman gets married and has a child, the pressure is heavy on her to quit her job. And many of them don't want to quit their job. And many of them would like to pursue a career. And if they get married and have children, that is very difficult to do. So that whole kind of thinking is in their heads. The other thing is they would like some help with the domestic activities. And many of the young guys to get married will promise them anything. And you can understand what this is all about. So they will promise, oh, yeah, I will help with the housework. I will help with the child care. I will help with all these kinds of things. And then they get married, and the woman is on her own. Well, the women see this with their friends, that they're not getting this kind of assistance from their husbands, and they wonder, why should I get into that? So a lot of them are just not getting married. They are not so much deciding not to get married. It just doesn't happen that they meet somebody that they want to marry and feel comfortable will be a lifelong partner in all kinds of activities. So it just doesn't happen for them.
Yeah, the final question in terms of the, it's still pretty much of a closed society, right? In other words, it's frowned on marrying outside of the particular culture.
Outsider.
Well, in other words, outside of Japanese, if a Japanese woman married an American or some other, it's not very well accepted.
That's a family-to-family issue. Some families are quite accepting of international marriages, and other families are just adamantly opposed. So that's a tough one to work out. The other way, and that is some of the young men are not finding a Japanese woman to marry, are looking overseas for a bride. And the village of Shinjo that I know, there have been two Chinese women who have married into those families. And none of those, one of them produced just a delightful little kid, but she left and the other one also left. So those marriages didn't last. What I'm hearing in Misasawa is that the Filipino wives are more committed to the family and therefore those marriages are more likely to work out than maybe others, but it's a tough situation. So international marriages in the village don't occur. The opportunity is not much there. And I don't expect to see that grow. In the big cities, the mega cities, as David Plath calls them, in Tokyo, there are a lot of international marriages. And I've had students who have been married internationally. And those marriages, many of them work out just fantastic. Some of my best friends are in those kinds of relationships. So I don't think those kinds of marriages differ from same country kinds of marriages.
Okay. One more caller here, Belgium, line four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning. Mm-hmm. I have a maybe an opposite direction to go with you on this. Both my children live in San Francisco, and one of them goes to Japan very regularly.
Congratulations.
Yes, and he has a friend who works over there, works as a English-speaking teacher. He doesn't speak Japanese, but he teaches English to them, which I find it interesting, and they just love going to Japan. They find the place exotic, irritating, just so exciting. They go back and back and back and back. Is this becoming more and more of a thing?
There are lots of people that do that. The Japanese government, in the JET program, for example, hires like 1,400 new college graduates to go to Japan and work in local school districts as Japanese teaching assistants. In their English program. And there are lots of people in the private schools who are teaching English to Japanese. So it is a common thing.
From what they say, they really don't want to learn to write or read English so much as they want to learn to speak English, conversational English especially.
That's new, and I think that's true. And the Japanese are traveling around the world. You see Japanese honeymooners on the planes going to various parts of the world, and they want to be able to communicate and speak. What they have learned in school is grammar and these kinds of things, but they can't speak. So they are interested on their own learning to speak the language because they understand how important that can be.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right. We're down to the point where we have a couple of minutes left. I would certainly suggest to people, if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, go stop by tonight at the Spurlock Museum and see the documentary because it's really nice. And I enjoyed looking at it. And just want to mention one other thing that happens late in the documentary that really I was really struck by, I guess, is at this point where you're talking about, or the documentary talks about the fact that you received a decoration from the emperor for your long work in Japan and I think also for promoting greater understanding between Japanese people and people in the United States. And there's some discussion of this, and there's a scene, you're standing outside on a road somewhere and talking with someone from the village. And he says something like, imagine that, someone from our little village getting an award from the emperor. And I'm thinking, man, that was really a sort of a spontaneous comment and say, yeah, how about that? Somebody from our town. That's an extraordinary level of acceptance there.
I was delighted with that award for one thing, and that is these people had invested in me for these decades and decades, and they didn't know who I was. They didn't know what I was doing, and they didn't know that there would be any effect of them helping me. But over the years, they had invested a lot in me and helped me a lot. And what this did then was validate that their investment was a good investment. So I was pleased on what it did for them in assuring them that all the time they wasted on trying to teach Brown something, that maybe it had some good effect.
This man actually amounted to something.
Well, their work amounted to something. So it was... It was their award.
Did you want to say that?
Well, but also, Keith doesn't like me saying this, but in over 50 years, he's become a local institution. He doesn't like being called an institution. He's a person. But there are many situations now when he goes to Mizusawa, or particularly to the village Shinjo, where he did the first research, he can't not participate. He has to participate in some of the events that are going on.
Because you've become one of them.
No, David asked me that question, and that's the title of his great documentary, Can't Go Native. He says, could you go native? And I said, no, of course I can't go native. Mm-hmm. My language is not good enough. And my mother gave birth to me in Iowa. I was an Iowa kid, the center of the universe. I can't go native. And I'll forever suffer from that.
Well, we're going to have to stop. I'm very sorry to say we're going to have to stop, but stop by tonight, 7 o'clock at the Knight Auditorium. That's at the Spurlock Museum on the campus on South Gregory, and see the film Can't Go Native, produced and directed by David Plath. He's Emeritus Professor of Anthropology here at the University of Illinois, and it's all about Keith Brown, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at University of Pittsburgh. Thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.